We present the News Quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
We start with a listing from this week's Radio Times, read by Harriet Cass.
Wednesday, BBC One, 9 p.m. The Secret Life of Elephants. The birth of a baby brings joy to one family, but her first few weeks turn out to be a dangerous time. Channel 4, 10 p.m. Could you eat an elephant?
And our thanks to Gary Patchett of Sunderland for sending that in. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, Phil Jupitus and Lawrence Howarth. And opposite them on my left, Clive Anderson and Jeremy Hardy. Phil, which group have been on a kind of northern rock and roll tour this week?
Our delightful Prime Minister, Mr. Brown, in order to reassure us all, has decided to go around the country saying that everything is OK, everything's fine, everything's good. So, he's on tour. He's going to be doing dates all around the country, finishing at Hammersmith Odeon, where he'll be recording his live album, featuring Money's Too Tight to Mention, Dear Prudence, and We've Got to Get Out of This Place. Gordon Brown sings the recession is not available in the shops because there aren't any shops anymore. He did a thing where he's going around. He said, "I should be visiting." And I can't do the accent, so I'll do my stock Scottish accent. "I shall be visiting factories and captains of industry."
It's the crankiest.
I know.
Gordon Brown in very tight underpants.
It's terrible. he's lower, isn't he? He's lower. Oh, hello. Also, I felt quite sorry for him this week because for some reason someone started going on about his favourite food and it's something called rumbledy thumps. It's the most, it sounds like, you know, you would think a Prime Minister, he's got a good job, he's done all right for himself, his tastes might improve a little. Apparently not. Rumbledy thumps, cabbage and potatoes and onions just smashed together, which is Bubble and Squeak, where I come from. But, oh, I love rumbledy thumps. And I think it explains why he's got that weird thing when he speaks, you know, because he goes, oh, the economy is... Oh. the problem with Britain today... That's the rumbledy thumbs talking.
This week, Gordon Brown went on tour to see how the nation is suffering during the recession. A cabinet meeting was held in Liverpool, which was followed by Alistair Darling having his legs stolen and being left propped up on some bricks in Topsfield. 2 points to Phil. Lawrence, where were they singing Hail to the Chief, the Three Ex-Chiefs and the One Chief to Be?
I think this is the President's Dinner, where all the surviving former presidents gathered round to give President-elect Obama the benefit of their collective schadenfreude. There was a lovely photo shot, though, of the five of them all together, a photo, and they looked like the least exciting boy band in history. Presidents, perhaps with a Z at the end, possibly.
West Wing life.
It makes a sort of sense because they do have, you know, in a sort of boy band, they all have to have a separate sort of identity. So you would have, you know, the young, fresh-faced one, the stupid one, the randy one, the one who's ashamed of the stupid one. and the one you sort of assumed was already dead.
Obama came up with the idea because he had a meeting with George W. last month and he came out thinking, do you know, I'm not doing another one of those on my own. Do you not think?
Again, Obama has said nothing. He said nothing. Because what has he said about the Middle East? And there is apparently a presidential protocol that in the run-up to you becoming president, the president-elect cannot say anything about savage Israeli aggression before the inauguration or after the inauguration. But he said, I'll have plenty to say once I'm the president.
But do you not think it's extraordinary that Obama saying nothing seems to have more authority than Bush speaking?
Yeah.
Bush saying nothing has more authority than Bush speaking.
Yeah, well, there is that. If they had a similar meeting of living British PMs, and presumably that couldn't happen. I mean, if Tony Blair's much too busy, if he stopped keeping the peace in the Middle East, heavens knows what would happen. Do you think Obama's going to say something about the Middle East? Do you think he's going to just keep quiet and quiet and quiet?
Who knows? Well, he'll have to say something when he's president. I mean, he did say he was concerned, which I suppose is better than... Do you know, I haven't given it very much thought.
Jeremy, did you read these Sunday papers this Sunday?
Every
paper went with Gaza, and apart from the News of the World, which went with Gaza. And it was a story about Paul Gascoigne. And I just wondered, somebody must have misheard somebody else in the office.
It's a good story, get on the front page, get Gaza.
The five past, present and future presidents of the United States met for lunch this week. The Times reported that all Democrats wore red ties, although the photo clearly showed Obama wearing a blue one, proving once and for all that colour is no longer the divisive issue it was in American politics. And in a show of unexpected ability, George W. even did up his own tie. So 2 points there to Lawrence. Clive, why have relations behind the Iron Curtain got distinctly colder?
For some reason, gas all comes from Russia, and it has to be piped through other countries. And because of some problem, Ukraine hasn't paid its gas bill for the last few months. It was when they took away... They used to have a sort of coin in the slot machine, and they could keep ahead of it then. They put their zlotys in the slot, I suppose. And do they have zlotys in? It's probably not Ukraine. No.
Part of the story as it's developed this week is there are, in fact, four pipes from Russia that lead through Ukraine, and they've sort of been turning them off one by one, like some sort of Bond villain, sort of increasing the misery and sort of saying, you have shown great resistance, the Ukraine. Let's see, though, if we turn off the fourth pipe.
What I didn't know is that in some of the former Eastern Bloc countries, they have the whole town will have a centralised heating system. I mean, can you imagine the fight over the thermostat? Half a million grannies versus the rest of the town. It would be a nightmare.
It also does put into a sort of perspective, we all worry about who do you get your gas from? You get, well, yeah, Russia is where I get my gas. It's a sort of a slightly less pushy version of N-Power.
You would be a bit worried if Putin knocked on your door asking to transfer your supply, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Or would you like to meet my piano wire?
Russia has cut the gas supply to the Ukraine in a dispute over unpaid bills, leaving 11 EU countries further down the pipeline with little or no supply. Russia is Europe's largest producer of gas, thanks to a cuisine based mainly on cabbage. Gazprom. Fantastic
that's
name.
That's the Bond villain name, isn't it? Gazprom. I represent Gazprom.
Gazprom, Russia's state gas monopoly, estimates that Ukraine owes it billions of dollars. They can't be more accurate, as Ukraine wasn't in when they tried to read the meter. Two points to Clive. Jeremy, who came in from the cold in a casual shirt?
The new Eliza Manningham Buller, whose name is something or other, Robert something.
Jonathan Evans.
Yeah, I knew that. He's the head of
MI5.
Oh, no. He's disappointingly banal. And you knew that it was going to be like that. You knew that it was going to be nothing like Spooks at MI5. You know, nothing as high-tech. You knew it was going to have a banding machine and a jar of mellow birds. And that the bloke in charge of internet surveillance spends all day on the phone to Microsoft technical support to find out how to open Outlook Express.
And, that is so very English, though, isn't it? Because I'm addicted to those programmes. You know those CSI programmes? And the other day on the news, there was a woman talking about British criminal forensics. And honest to goodness, in the background was a person in a white coat with some sellotape trying to get hairs off a sweater. And I thought, oh! that is the difference, isn't it? Between all that touchscreen computer. Yeah. Oh, hang on a minute, I'll get that off with a bit of sellotape.
That was gathering evidence. That was vital fibres. He's obviously not the real head. There's another secret service we don't. For years they denied there was a secret service. Now they say, oh yeah, we went here's and they are actors they've brought into play.
Oh,
this pretend MI5. There's a MI7 and MI8 that really does the work.
Do you think that he's just like a glove puppet?
Yeah. Well,
the real M is behind with his hand up him.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course.
Because he did say, he said MI5 doesn't kill people or arrange assassinations. And you think that's what I'd say if I did that for a living. I'd say, no, that's nothing to do with us. We don't have anything to do with that.
He's not going to say, don't ask me any questions or I'll have you killed, is he? I know where you live.
The new director of M15. No, that can't be right.
Isn't MFI in receivership at the moment?
Jonathan Evans has become the first head of MI5 to give an interview. It represented a major policy change for the Secret Service and Probably a hell of a booking for the Graham Norton show. No, but Jonathan Evans, it sounds like one of your children's primary school classmates. You can just imagine yourself going, oh, darling, you've brought the wrong PE kit home again. I've just washed Jonathan Evans' swimming trunks. At the end of round one, the scores are Phil and Lawrence have got 4 points, but so too have Clive and Jeremy. We start round two with a cutting from the Middletown Journal.
A 37-year-old Oxford woman was arrested on January the 2nd for allegedly shoplifting a parenting book while accompanied by her two young children. The shop assistant told police the woman had concealed in her handbag hand towels, a small rug, and a book entitled 101 Ways to Be a Good Mum.
Thanks to Ian Dunn from Stockton-on-Tees for sending us that. Phil, who thinks that those who can do and those who can't bore?
It's the inspector for schools. Is it Christine Jenkins?
Gilbert.
Gilbert Jenkins? Gilbert Jenkins. apparently, yes, but it's the shock news that teachers who are boring don't get the best out of their pupils. Teachers who are boring, it's my own time I'm wasting. so, yeah, apparently this Christine Gilbert has come up with this, and she sort of said, when I was head of a schools inspection authority, we did a little experiment about teachers, and we found that some of them that were dull didn't get the best out of their pupils. Well, duh. It's hard. It's like, you know, it's not the greatest stretch of the imagination to find out that, you know, teachers who don't capture their lovely young subjects don't get the best out of them. And it's even more difficult these days because you are competing with Grand Theft Auto, crack, chlamydia, any number of exciting alternatives to be sitting in doing Key Stage 1 maths.
Do you want teaching to be more exciting, or do you want to come back from the geography field trip with the same number of children you left with?
There you go. You did learn from maths, you see. Yeah. That's applied maths, what you just did there, Sandy, you see.
But do you not think history could be more exciting if you got rid of that ridiculous rule of only teaching things that actually happen? I mean... Get rid of Simon Sharma and bring in Dan Brown. I think that would be the...
It must be said that teachers might be boring, but it's more to do, surely, with teenagers have an extraordinary capacity to get bored. Mm. You know, a teacher will say, good morning, class, and they go, oh, I'm so bored! That's so boring, you're so boring! And, you know, there's not a lot you can do that. If every 2 seconds you've got to do something incredibly interesting, that's not really a teaching lesson. That's, I don't know what that is, it's a circus or something.
But some of it's supposed to be boring. Do you not think if children find calculus exciting, they haven't really understood it? I mean, surely... Anybody have a very good teacher? Anybody have very good
teachers? Yeah. Mrs. Blanks was a very good teacher. She taught English. But we already spoke that, so it wasn't that hard.
I had a wonderful sports teacher called Miss Doswell, and she spotted early on that sport and I were never going to be good friends. And she was fine. We used to laugh. She'd say, right, girls, I want to watch. She had a marvellous, an overbite, the like of which you'd rarely see outside of a farmyard. And she would say, right, girls, we're all going to run once round the track to warm up. And I'd say, oh, look, you know, I'll wait here. I mean, if you're all coming back anyway.
I had a teacher who wrote on a report about me. Philip seems to find snail's pace exhausting. And I'd like that teacher to know that the laugh and the subsequent money I get for that joke is going to me.
Ofsted is launching a campaign against boring teaching, which they believe worsens children's behaviour. The Chief Inspector of Schools, Christine Gilbert, said Ofsted inspectors will be asked to assess why pupils are not paying attention in class. Good heavens, if boredom leads to poor behaviour, the listeners of Moneybox Live must be rioting in the streets. Ofsted said teachers rely too much on textbooks and preparing for tests. And if Ofsted ever find out who's been imposing these curriculums and testing regimes, going to be pretty cross.
Because the private schools are covered by Ofsted, are they? But the boarding schools are covered by Oftos.
So there was 2 points there to whoever I asked the question to. Phil. Lawrence, have a listen to this. The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round, round and round. On the bus, go round and round, all day long. Lawrence, what has been spookily running perfectly on time?
When I read about this story, I felt slightly spooked because I think a few years ago I commuted on a ghost bus without realising it. In fact, So I used to get a bus to Ealing Broadway, which is obviously the sort of Hampton Court of ghost buses. And I was working at Ealing Studios, and I was living in Willesden at the time. And it turned out there was a bus, and it was called the PR1.
PR is a medical abbreviation for per rectum. So you were taking your life in your hands.
Yeah.
Or it could have been the Polar Rover, and they could have taken you to meet Santa.
It was slightly less exciting. That PR stands for Park Royal, which, if you've been to that bit of London, is neither a park nor regal.
It does sound scary, though, doesn't it? The ghost bus. And then if they had a skeleton service, that'd be even more scary. Like in Pirates of the Caribbean.
But it is an odd route, isn't it? This goes from Ealing to somewhere in sort of South London.
It goes to Wandsworth. Yes. It takes 70 minutes.
What's odd about the journey from Ealing to Wandsworth?
Well, you can see
through a wardrobe in a Narnia.
They had those adverts that, what's his name? Richard Dawkins, the professional atheist. He had those ads on the sides of buses that said, God probably doesn't exist. You should have some now on that one. Says, God probably doesn't exist, and neither does this bus.
He is irritating, isn't he, Dawkins? He's a really zealous evangelical atheist. He's a sort of Jehovah's I never saw nothing, isn't he?
It does make me laugh, though, because he was on the Today programme with some bishop, and the bishop gave some long, terribly learned, rather dull answer to something, and Dawkins just said, I don't know why we should listen to him just because he's got an imaginary friend.
The South Circular goes Ealing to Wandsworth. That's where the way it would go. It's taken me a while to... I've just been thinking, which way would I go? Would I come down through...
Oh, my God, you're
A4,
one of those men at parties who came, you know... down the A3 using the straight-arm driving technique. According to the Times, the government has avoided the public consultation that would come with closing a rail service through Ealing, West London, by replacing it with an unadvertised weekly bus service. According to the transport correspondent, the 50-seat executive coach, in case anybody wants to catch it, departs every Tuesday at 9:45 from Ealing Broadway Station to Wandsworth Road in South London. And by providing this ghost bus, the Department of Transport does not need to consult the public about the service closure. Do you know, I think I've called the ghost bus before. Explains all those times I've woken up with no memory of how I got back from the pub. 2 points to Lawrence. Clive, whose claims are far from healthy? If I told you I was going to start selling Sandy detox fig water...
Oh, yes, this is detox diets. Apparently we don't need anything to detox ourselves. We have a liver, which does pretty well most of the time, and having your sort of colon irrigated or special diets with only lettuce in it makes no difference at all. Who would have thought? Who would have thought there are people trying to sell you stuff that's actually of no difference whatsoever? So it's brilliant that's being pointed out.
Except that when I was extraordinary, he said that get a good night's sleep is a solution to most problems. And you think, no, it isn't. What if the question is, how can I park my car in that space? I don't know.
Food intolerant people. I mean, I can't look at food. Oh, it just turns brown and falls out of my bottom. Oh. You know, you get these people say, I find wheat makes me bloat. 30-year-olds. Oh, wheat makes me bloated. Try being 47. Everything makes you bloody bloated. Feeling ill and bloated and disgusting is the price you pay for not starving today.
Sir Colin Berry, who's Professor Emeritus at the University of London, says the best way to detox is to stop drinking, silly boy.
No, you die of thirst.
A report by the charity Sense About Science says the claims made by detox products are misleading and lack scientific evidence. Actually, to be honest, I had a 3-day detox over Christmas. Well, I undercooked the turkey. to be honest, the rest was out of my control. 2 points to Clive. Jeremy, which sector of the economy has rooms for improvement?
We're rubbish at running hotels, which potentially could harm the economy to the tune of £4 billion. But I don't know over what period or whether that's once or per day. In The Witch Guide, they found all manner of horrible things, including, they said, a loose fingernail. Now, note loose fingernail. If it had said a fingernail, that would mean a fingernail. Loose fingernail suggests it is still attached, which means they found a finger.
But did it need Witch magazine to discover that cheap hotel chains have poor levels of hygiene? Oh, duh. I mean, you just think it was an extraordinary thing. It was the most extraordinary report. In one hotel, Witch discovered mould, blood, urine and faeces. Sound like a firm of solicitors on a business trip. And we went down to Cornwall. I'm never going again. It's an awfully long way. And it's like somebody just stretched and stretched and stretched the country. And the closer you get to the end, they go, it's a bit further. And stayed in not a very salubrious place. And I said to the concierge, could I have a wake-up call? He said, your career's in a rut. You're not getting any younger.
Sandy Toxic, hey! Sandy Toxic.
I'm here all week. Try the beer. Yeah.
Do they still have friendly hotels? I used to like friendly hotels. There's one in Hull, and its slogan was, it pays to stay friendly, which sounds more like a threat from the mob, doesn't it?
Christopher Rodriguez has warned that grumpy hotel staff are putting off foreign visitors at a time when Britain's economy needs them most. Gordon Brown has this week launched Visit Britain's Value campaign, which makes the country sound like a tin of beans. At the end of round two, the scores are Phil and Lawrence have got 8 points, but so too have Clive and Jeremy. Before we start round three, here's a story from the Wiltshire Gazette and Herald.
A herd of deer was saved from death after Wiltshire College Lacombe adopted the animals for a 12.5-acre park, which opened this week. The college intends to use the herd to produce venison to be sold at the Lacombe Farm Shop.
And our thanks to Peter Bird of Chippenham for sending us that. Lawrence, what's dying out and with bells on?
Well, this is the very sad, or depending on your view, not at all sad news, that Morris dancing may become extinct.
Yeah, once again, with feeling.
Yeah, you've never actually danced, though, have you? You don't care that much. I think, in a way, though, it's quite appropriate in the year that is the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth that Morris dancing should die out, because, of course, if you're going to have the survival of the fittest, you also need, by definition, to have the demise of the lamest. And the spokesman thought that the reason that they were dying out was that the young people were too embarrassed to do it. And I thought that's a tremendously optimistic view. They don't want to, is the reason. The idea of them sort of sitting on the sidelines of a Morris dance going, oh, if only I had the pluck to get up there. Dare I? Could I? Should I? I don't think that's quite how it goes.
If really. Only I had the bells to do it. Yes.
A lot of information that I didn't know about. There are six predominant styles of Morris dancing, including Northwest Morris, which is more military in style. In fact, several Northwest Morris teams have served with distinction in Afghanistan, causing untold merriment amongst the Taliban, I would imagine. Border Morris, which, I don't know, is performed by sheepdogs. And if you're being buzzed by a biplane in a cornfield, that's North by Northwest Morris.
I'll tell you why it's dying out. It's the accordions. If you up the music a bit, if they were out there doing the sticks and the stuff to a little bit of something, you'd be all right. You know, a little bit of proper music.
What's just a man whistling, I don't think, though. It's hardly going to carry down the high street.
I want to stick up for Morris dancing. It's a final. I can't say I like it, but I want to stick up for it anyway, because it's a good activity. But they can... You say it's becoming extinct. They can bring it back to life. There's a story this week about bringing things back to life that used to be extinct. They can get the DNA to do that.
What are they going to do, breed Morris dancing? Yes, they'll breed...
Think how brilliant Jurassic Park would be. You've got Jeff Goldblum and a bunch of people in a minibus driving around this sort of jungly thing, and suddenly all these blokes dressed in white with funny hats leap out in front of them.
Jeff Goldblum going to the kids, don't move, their vision is based on cider.
Well, according to the Daily Telegraph, so it must be true, Britain's Morris dancers face extinction unless younger participants can be found. 2 points to Lawrence. This is my favourite story of the week. Clive, who packed something old, something new, something borrowed, and a pink lilo?
Well, it's presented in the papers as a heartwarming story. It's three German kids, decided two things. Well, two of them wanted to get married, and they're about 5 or 6 years old or something like that. They want to get married to each other, male and female, and they took another one along to be the witness. And they, A, wanted to get married, but B, they wanted to go to Africa to do it. So they set off, and it's a strange comment on our times. If it had been African kids trying to get to Germany, they'd be in a raft and they'd be arrested and kept in some sort of detention centre for 6 months while the whole thing was sorted out. But because they're going the other way, it was a touching story, and they wanted to go to Africa, and... So off they set. They got as far as the local railway station where some sort of ghost bus was running. And they were... No, in Germany it would be something crazy like a train. They said, oh, this can't be right. And they took them back to their parents, and it was all, as I say, a touching story.
Bear in mind they tried to take Stalingrad wearing flip-flops and Bermuda shorts. It's not that. There is
yes,
a history
you're back
of
to
this.
The war,
there is a history of this.
I like the fact that Mika, the little boy, apparently, he regaled... the girls, the younger girls, with stories of an Italian holiday he'd been on. Can a six-year-old regale? Don't you have to have a smoking jacket?
When the kids are down the train station with the Lilos and the floppy hats and the sun oil, it's a heartwarming story. When I do it, it's drunk and disorderly.
Was he on holiday with his family, or was it some city break with a couple of mates from playgroup? Do we know?
I think it was his stag night, actually.
Stag night. Oh, no more jelly. I couldn't possibly be. Pleasingly, six-year-old Mika and five-year-old Annabelle have confirmed that they still intend to marry. They denied the age gap was an issue. The three children, aged 5, 6, and 7... left their parents' house and walked 3/4 of a mile to the tram stop. It could never happen here, could it? Imagine in Britain, 3 children capable of walking 3/4 of a mile. 2 points to Clive. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings the teams have brought along from Lawrence.
Well, I'm very grateful to Keith and Elaine Edwards from Tattershall in Lincolnshire, who found this in The Independent on Sunday. And it's from a Vox Pop. And the question asked was, how well do you know your neighbours? And one reply was, the lady next door had Alzheimer's. I went in daily and took a Sunday lunch.
Clive.
This is from Barry Webster from Loch Ilped in Argyll. And this is from the Argyllshire Advertiser sports section, the 19th of December of last year. And it's an account of a golf tournament. Keith Cowan had injured his back while watching his wife put up the Christmas decorations and did well to play.
Jeremy.
This was sent in by Ian Stratton. Doesn't say where he's from. It's from the Croydon Guardian, so let's assume he's from Croydon. And it's from the letters page. And Anne Giles of Selsdon writes, I'm sure most of us have skeletons in our cupboards. I found my father's one after he died, and then my father-in-law's.
Take a look at the final score. Phil and Lawrence have got 11 points, but this week's winners are Clive and Jeremy with 14. And before we leave you, here's a cutting from the BBC News website sent in by Alexander Priest of Oxford.
The Royal Mail is to release special sets of stamps each month in 2009. January's collection will feature classic British designs from the miniskirt to the mini. Later sets will feature mythical creatures such as mermaids, post boxes, eminent Britons, Royal Naval uniforms, and the fire service.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Phil Jupiters, Lawrence Howarth, Clive Anderson, and Jeremy Hardy. In the chair was Sandy Toksvig, and the news was read by me, Harriet Cass. The chair's script was written by Simon Littlefield, Roderick Crooks, and James Sherwood, with additional material by Stephen Carlin and Gareth Gwynn. The producer was Victoria Lloyd.